Case number 20-1783, Constant A.P. Barrett and Dollar S. Barrett, appellants versus Eldon Management. Mr. Shelley, amicus curiae, Ms. Barrett for the appellants, Ms. Alexander for the appellee.
All right, Mr. Shelley, we'll hear from you first.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Anthony Shelley, the amicus. The district court has generously established a mediation program free to all civil litigants for cases before that court. The district court, in turn, has established the ground rules for its mediation program, one of which is that the program generally is available only to parties with counsel. And the second is that no agreement in a mediation is binding unless signed by all the parties and their counsel. The Barretts here were pro se below, but Judge Kelly appointed counsel for them so that they could participate in the mediation program. Importantly, on the day of the mediation, the parties entered an agreement to govern the mediation. This agreement was signed by all parties and all counsel, and it appears at the supplemental appendix at pages 112 and 113. This mediation agreement itself expressly stated, following the local rules, that no settlement agreement reached in mediation would be binding unless signed by the parties and their counsel. And to this agreement, the mediation counsel did sign. So it's not just the local rules that required counsel signatures on a settlement, but also the very contract setting up the mediation in the first place. The mediation occurred, and of course, the Barretts counsel did not sign the settlement document. In the amicus's view, plain and simple, whether under the contract signed by the parties on the morning of the mediation or under the district court's local rules, the lack of a counsel signature for the appellants means that the settlement agreement is not binding. The court asked me as amicus to address the application of the district court's local rule 84.7F, which is the counsel signature requirement, to address that with respect to this case. In my brief, I explained that the rule applies and requires reversal of Judge Lambert's order enforcing the settlement agreement. But as I just noted, even going before getting to the local rule, the court can find that the party's contract setting up the mediation for closed enforcement of the settlement agreement in the first instance, since it contained a requirement that all counsel sign, and they did not sign. But getting to the local rule, it's plain wording for closes enforcement of the settlement here. Rule 84.7F, without any conditions or qualifiers, says that counsel must sign the settlement agreement for it to be binding. Judge Lambert respectfully did linguistic gymnastics, really, in trying to find the rule followed or at least inapplicable. And in the end, God bless you, Your Honor. And in the end, rested basically on a proposition that counsel means counsel who's made an appearance for the whole case, not counsel just appointed for the mediation. And there's really nothing in the word counsel itself that suggests that, and there's nothing anywhere in the local rule 84.7 or the rules surrounding it involving mediation to suggest Judge Lambert's gloss on this. In fact, if you look throughout Rule 84.7, counsel shows up many times and it has to mean mediation counsel. For instance, in 84.7C, the rule says that there can be separate meetings between four parties and separate meetings for counsel. It has to include mediation counsel because that's the only counsel there. Rule 84.7D says counsel must notify the court of a settlement by filing a dismissal stipulation. That has to mean mediation counsel. Rule 84.8A says that counsel and parties must attend the mediation sessions. That has to mean mediation counsel. And most important, 84.4C says that the parties must be represented by counsel for purposes of mediation, for it even to start. And that clearly must mean mediation counsel. But somehow the word counsel takes on a different gloss in the part that says counsel must sign the mediation agreement. Judge Lambert pointed, the only thing he really pointed to was his confidence. He used the word confidence that this reading, his reading was right, but respectfully again, the plain wording doesn't support that, nor does the purpose. The purpose is to assist the litigant, the actual litigant, in understanding the mediation and not signing, not being bound by it, unless that was fully in their best interest in the counsel's view. And here, without the counsel, in a way, Judge Lambert set up a situation where a party that's represented would have more protection than a pro se party because their counsel would have to sign, as opposed to in the pro se situation, they'd be left on their own, even though they had counsel. So on the plain wording of the rule, as well as its purpose, it's simply doesn't support the reading that Judge Lamberth adopted in this case. And for the reasons we've stated in our brief, we think that the Judge Lamberth's order should be reversed and the case should be remanded back to Judge Kelly for further proceedings on the merits.
Do you have any suggestion as between the local rule theory and the contract theory? Is there any reason we should prefer one over the other?
Well, only as a matter of judicial restraint, in a way, if in the sense that you could limit your decision to this case alone, if you go with the contract that the party signed, the contract that the party signed at the beginning of the day on the mediation, as opposed to making a hard and fast rule for all of the lower courts to follow. But honestly, the lower courts probably could use some guidance on this. And in that respect, a bright line reading of this, the rule is a bright line construction is what's appropriate. It's an easy rule to follow. It's easy for people to sign. And it's an objective indication when there's no signature that it's not binding. But if the court wanted to limit its ruling to simply this case alone, then you could decide it on the contract theory.
Okay, Judge Ginsburg, any questions?
No, not at all, thank you.
Judge Walker, I hope you're still here. I don't see you. Did we lose Judge Walker?
Come on. Judge Walker has dropped from this meeting. We're trying to get him back on.
Okay, we will pause, I hope, for just a minute or two while that happens.
I apologize very much. My internet went out.
No problem. I think we lost you pretty much at the end of Mr. Shelley's presentation. You were getting some feedback.
That's right, Judge Katsas.
You have any questions?
I don't. And I again apologize to all for the inconvenience.
No problem. Ms. Is it Barrett? Go ahead and unmute yourself. Ms. Okay. Barrett, did I say your name right?
Yes, my name is Dolores Barrett.
Okay, your amicus has made some strong arguments on your behalf, but we welcome anything further that you would like to present to us. Go ahead, please.
Good morning, Your Honor. My husband and I, Constante Barrett, are the appellants and we are pro se. Local civil rule 84.7 parenthesis F provides that for a mediated settlement agreement to be enforceable and binding, it must be signed by the parties, that is, the plaintiffs and the defendant and the respective lawyers. The mediated settlement agreement that was signed on November 13, 2019 was not enforceable and not valid because it was not signed by the defendant, Aldon Management, who was represented by the insurance broker during that mediation. The counsels for the Barrotts, the appellants, the court-appointed counsels did not also sign in that mediation settlement agreement. The memorandum order of Judge Lambert, the dispute resolution compliance judge, dated February 6, 2020, denying our request for revocation of the mediated settlement agreement and granting the motion of the appellee, the Aldon Management, to enforce the mediation settlement as well as Judge Lambert's decision or judgment dated August 12, 2020 are not consistent with local Civil Rule 84.7 parenthesis F, because he enforced the mediated settlement, and yet it is wrong because it was not, the mediated settlement was not signed by all parties in the respective council. In fact, in the rulings of Judge Lambert in Hall versus George Washington University and in Davis versus National Council of Negro Women Incorporated,
Ms. Barreau, we have lost you for the moment. Can you hear us? Ms. Barreau?
Judge, we have lost the connection with Ms. Barreau. Would you like me to call her?
Recommend, Anne. You want to try to just get her by telephone?
I will call her right now. Ms. Barrett's connection is back on.
Okay. Ms. Barrett, can you hear me?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Just,
and you cut out, so glad to have you back. You have about a minute left.
And additionally, the mediated settlement agreement was not signed by the court-appointed lawyers for us, the appellants. I think, thank you.
Thank you very much. Do my colleagues have any questions?
No, that was clear. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. Ms. Alexander, we'll hear from you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The compliance judge did not abuse his discretion in finding the existence of an enforceable settlement agreement between the parties and thereby denying appellant's motion to revoke the settlement agreement. This is because there indeed was an enforceable agreement under both common law contract principles as well as under the local rule. The parties reached an agreement to settle the case after 5 long hours of mediation. All parties and their counsel were present. Indeed, the appellants were represented by 3 attorneys from the Georgetown University Law Center who were appointed to appellants for the mediation. And the material terms of that settlement were reduced to writing, and that writing was signed by both appellants and myself as counsel for the appellee, with the understanding that a more formal release would be executed at a later time. 5 days following that mediation, the appellants filed the motion to revoke. And it's significant that the appellants filed this motion pro se and not under the signature of their counsel who was appointed to represent them at that time. The matter was then properly referred to the compliance judge, who held a hearing with all counsel, the parties, the mediator, and the director of the circuit executive mediation program to discuss the appellant's change of heart. And then the court, after that hearing, decided that the appellant's counsel had participated in the settlement negotiations and that the appellant's counsel had satisfactorily confirmed to the court that they did not object to the ultimate agreement. The fact that the court was satisfied that appellant's counsel had no objection to the agreement has the same effect as if the agreement had been signed by counsel for purposes of Local Rule 84.7F. It was clear to the court that counsel.
Why is that? The rule is clear as can be that the agreement is not binding unless it's signed by counsel.
Well, there are two ways to interpret local rule 84.7. One would be that it, which would render it invalid under the Rules Enabling Act, because the Rules Enabling Act is limited to regulating only procedure. So to conclude that there was an enforceable agreement would allow the court to exceed its authority in drafting local rule,
That's not exactly right, though. You need to, Rules Enabling Act says that a court rule under 2071 is invalid to the extent it's inconsistent with a federal statute, or in this case, a federal rule of civil procedure, which is a rule of practice or procedure prescribed under 2072. So what's the federal rule of civil procedure with which this court rule is inconsistent?
Well, it's that this rule is inconsistent with a substantive right. The Rules Enabling Act authorizes district courts to craft local rules to implement or fill in the gaps between national rules of practice and procedure. The local rules must be limited to regulating the judicial process for enforcing rights and duties recognized by substantive law. So if the rule regulates the manner and the means by which the litigants' rights are enforced, then the rule is valid. If it alters the rules of decision by which the court will adjudicate those rights, it is not valid. And here, the local rule extends beyond being procedural in nature if it's interpreted as taking away a substantive right, that substantive right being the liberty to enter into a contract and the liberty to enforce the contract. The other way, and we submit this is the proper interpretation of local rule 84.7F, that is, would be valid under the Rules Enabling Act and would be consistent with the substantive law of contracts, is that the rule simply provides a single method for creating an enforceable agreement. And that is how Colorado has viewed a similar local rule. Unfortunately, there's no case directly on point in this jurisdiction, and therefore I urge this court to look to a California case, not as authority, but for guidance on the issue. In Yackel versus Andrews, which is 195 Pacific 3rd 1101, Colorado has a statutory requirement found in Section 308 of their Dispute Resolution Act, which requires settlement agreements to be reduced to writing and approved by the parties and their attorneys. So the Colorado statute is very similar to the local rule at issue here. And in Yackel, the U.S. District Court for the District of Colorado held that the statute does not abrogate the common law of contracts in the context of mediation proceedings. The Colorado statute does not mandate a single method that must be followed for the formation of a binding agreement in mediations. It simply provides one method. There, the court construed common law contract principles alongside the Dispute Resolution Act and held that provisions of the act outline a process by which parties can turn an agreement reached during mediation into an enforceable court order. The local rule merely provides a method, not the only method, for turning a mediated settlement agreement into an enforceable order of court.
So I understand what you're saying. Everything you're saying goes to the local rule. Why isn't the pre-settlement contract requiring counsel mimicking the local rule but separate from it? Why is that not valid?
Well, Subsequent to entering into that agreement to proceed with the mediation, the parties engaged in discussions for 5 hours and agreed to terms that altered that agreement because they settled the case. They settled the case.
They didn't complete the process because they didn't sign the agreement.
Well, and that's correct, Your Honor. And that's why any disputes involved in arising out of the mediation process then get deferred to the compliance judge. And the hearing was held. All the parties were present. All the attorneys were present. The mediator was present. And the compliance judge, in honoring the policy preference for maintaining the confidentiality of mediation, had this closed hearing and came away satisfied that the parties did indeed reach an enforceable agreement. And that was evidenced further by the fact that the attorneys didn't file the motion to revoke. The appellants filed the motion pro se. Their counsel never filed any objection to the agreement that was entered into. In fact, they withdrew as counsel.
For all we know, their counsel, or let's maybe even hypothetically, let's say, counsel for the pro se plaintiffs loses interest or has something more important to do. And so when the parties seem to have agreed on everything and reduced it to writing, he basically just leaves, right? Leaves them to on their own. And then somewhat embarrassed by that, says later when asked by the compliance judge, do you have any objection to it? Says no. Never said why he didn't sign it, did he?
That's correct. There's nothing on the record that says why counsel didn't sign the agreement. There's nothing that indicates that there was any further discussion about having counsel sign that agreement. However, we know that the compliance judge came away from that hearing satisfied that the attorneys had no objection. And the appellants themselves have never indicated that their attorneys did in fact object to
the attorney asked that question, whether you object to the settlement that you didn't sign, is hardly in a position freely to say, yes, I object. I don't think it's a good agreement. And that's why I didn't sign it, right? Because it was negligent not to sign it.
Well, ordinarily, absent the Circuit Executive Mediation Program, a settlement agreement can be entered into between the parties without their attorneys signing off on the agreement. The purpose of
plaintiffs here, who maybe for good reason said, we're not confident what we're doing when we sign the agreement. We really need to be countersigned by our counsel.
Counsel had the opportunity to raise any objection and to advocate on behalf of their clients and to join in and, in fact, to file their motion to revoke the settlement agreement after the appellants had a change of heart. They did not. The appellants filed that pro se, and then the attorneys withdrew their representation afterwards. Because of all these facts, the fact that the attorneys didn't file the motion, what the compliance judge heard at the hearing, there's a reasonable basis for the compliance judge to come away and make and draw the conclusion that the attorneys did not object at the time that the agreement was entered into, to the agreement itself. This is absent this local rule, there's no question that this is a binding agreement. All of the material terms are written. The parties.
The local rule undoes the agreement.
Well, Your Honor, I submit that in the event that the local rule is interpreted as taking away a substantive right, it's not a valid rule. Alternatively, the local rule can be viewed as providing one procedural mechanism for creating a enforceable settlement contract, but it doesn't take away.
But as you said before, but not the only method, right?
Correct.
What is the other method other than what happened to just a common law agreement, which is not valid?
Well, you can enter into an agreement absent the, if you weren't going through the circuit mediation program, you could enter into an agreement without having the attorneys sign the agreement. And the reason for the rule, the local rule, is to discourage oral agreements. And the reason for that is that the courts want to maintain confidentiality in the mediation process. And that's why 84.7 was added to the local rules in the first place. And you can find this preference for maintaining the confidentiality of a settlement agreement throughout the local rules. And that's one of the reasons why the dispute was then deferred to the compliance judge, is to keep the discussions in the mediation process from flowing to the adjudicating judge. So it's that process that then satisfies the judge that there's an enforceable agreement in place, absent what's provided for in the local rule 84.7, absent the signatures of counsel.
I have your point. Thank you.
Judge Walker, anything? Oh, one last question for you, Ms. Alexander, quickly. We've handled this entire appeal under seal. Strikes me that a lot of the legal issues we're talking about can we appropriately share with the public and should. Would you have any objection to unsealing?
I do not.
Okay, thank you. All right. Ms. Barrett, you have a minute for rebuttal. Before you begin, let me just ask you the same question. Would you have any objection to us making these proceedings public?
No, Your Honor. I want everything to be public.
Okay, thank you. You have a minute.
This is in connection with the mediated settlement agreement. And according to Judge Lambert, on May 17, 2001, the court amended local civil procedure by adding local civil rule 84.7 parenthesis F in order for a mediated settlement agreement to be enforceable. So the LCVR 84.7 parenthesis F was not complied with in this mediated settlement agreement. Therefore, the mediated settlement agreement that was dated November 13, 2019 is not enforceable and not binding because it is not in accordance with 84.7 parenthesis F. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Shelley, I know this is beyond the scope of your assignment, but do you have any thoughts on whether we should do anything other than just unseal the entire appeal? I know the district court has a confidentiality provision, but we don't like secret proceedings. And frankly, nothing that we've talked about strikes me as anything that should remain secret.
Yeah, I certainly have no personal objection myself, and I don't see anything in the, as long as the parties don't object, it seems as though the court could go through and make the matter public.
Okay, thank you. My colleagues have any questions for the amicus?
No, thanks.
No, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Shelley, you were appointed by the court as an amicus to help us work through the issues in the case, and you have ably discharged your responsibilities, for which we are grateful.
Thank you, Your Honor.